The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. I'll spare you any lengthy intro because we're a little bit short on time today, but I will warn everyone that we've chosen to record this at the very end of the day on a Friday, and I know I've had a very long week, and I'm pretty sure Jim has as well, so this could be either very fun and spontaneous in a good way, or could be a little rough around the edges. We'll just kind of see how it goes and how our mental capacities hold up here at the end of a Friday afternoon. So, Jim, you notice how I lumped myself into that category that you sometimes mention, you know.
I agree. I appreciate that.
Yeah, so not just you.
No. Usually you're the one throwing me under the boat, but today you're like, nope, this could be Jim, it could be me, it's Friday afternoon.
Well, there's another one, or the first one. Throw you the under what? The boat instead of under the bus. It's all good. I warned people right at the beginning.
You can be thrown under a boat, realize that.
How's that going to happen?
Boat's moving in the water, you're on another boat, and someone throws you off that boat, and the other moving boat goes right over you.
You're going to hit the water before you go under it. It's going to keep you.
No, boat go, no. Okay. No, trust me, it's a saying. It's a saying back east where we have boats.
Okay.
But anyways, folks, it is Friday. It is late in the evening, afternoon. Do you have any weekend plans?
I have to do some repair work on my daughter's car tomorrow. While it's nice out, I've been putting off a little maintenance, and tomorrow is a beautiful day on a weekend, and I'm going to take advantage of that.
Well, that sounds fun.
Mm-hmm. Beyond that,
I hope.
Super exciting.
Not too much going on in my life. Hopefully, listeners, you've had or will be having a good weekend. But I'll probably be doing some yard work. I'm going to try to do some gardening, get the garden up and going. Should be getting my peas in the ground soon, and I need to uncover my strawberries. So get that going this weekend. Probably go on a little walk or a little hike, and that's about it. Weekend goes by so fast.
Hmm. Do you cover your strawberries with straw?
Well, technically, yes, but I'll put weed fabric down first to keep the seeds in the straw from getting into the strawberry bed. Hmm. And then I'll cover it with a layer of straw and then leaves. You're not supposed to do leaves. But because I have that weed fabric down and it can remove them very easy, it's no big deal. Mm. Out here in Colorado, it's not the cold that kills the strawberries. It's the wind. As you know, November through March is our windy season. And when we get the frozen ground and those strong winds that come out of the west when the storms are dumping a ton of snow in Aspen and Vail, and they just hit us as wind, it just dries the leaves out and kills your strawberries. So you definitely have to cover them. It's certainly not the cold that kills them. It's the frozen ground and then the wind that kills them. Now, in northern climates, where they actually get snow that doesn't melt the next day, that covers the strawberries and protects them, but we don't, so I have to cover them. So there's a little bit of gardening information, folks, whether you wanted it or not.
Well, I'm just pleased to hear that your strawberries actually involve straw.
But yes, they do involve straw to one degree, because I will cover them with weed fabric, straw, then burlap. Then I put snow fence on top of that, not to keep snow off, but to tie everything down with a ratchet set. To keep it from blowing away. Because the first year I did it, worked wonderful till the winds came, blew everything off it. So now I learned, and I weave the ratchet through the snow fence and tie it down with stakes. It's quite ingenious. It works wonderful, and it doesn't go anywhere, and my strawberries make it every year.
Nice.
All right, let's get into the nitty-gritty. People aren't listening to this just to hear us yap about strawberries and gardening in the weekend. We will start with Social Security questions, as we always do. This gentleman did give us a hint. I'm not sure if you will get this. And he didn't name the presidents. It intrigued me, being a history buff, but I would have wished he would have named the presidents. So anyways, he begins. Hi, Jim and Chris. Thank you for all you two fine gentlemen and your staff do to educate people on finances. There's no podcast like yours. You folks occupy a special niche. Thank you.
I bet we're the only one that starts off talking about strawberries and fixing your daughter's car over the weekend.
Probably.
Right there, we're one of one. Yeah, one of one.
Okay. I have a question on Social Security I have not heard asked on the show. But first, my riddle. I am from a state with five U.S. presidents who fought in the Civil War. So that one surprised me, because I'm thinking, okay, after the Civil War, what five presidents would have been from this one state? And what five presidents fought in the Civil War?
Why does it have to be after the Civil War?
I don't know of any presidents
who then fought after being president.
Who then fought in the Civil War after being president.
True. But they could have. Maybe. I don't know. Anytime there's a large volume of presidents from one place, it kind of leads me to just a few states. I'm going to guess Virginia, maybe.
Virginia would have been a good one, but they were for the Confederacy.
They didn't say which side they fought on.
They're from the state. True. Just that U.S. president who fought in the Civil War.
Yeah.
True. Very good point. You're wrong. You're close. Mm. It's a state very, very close to Virginia.
Pennsylvania?
Close to that as well, I may move someday.
Oh, there must be Ohio.
Ohio. Yeah, that's what he says, Ohio. I'll have to Google and figure out what five presidents are from Ohio and that fought in the Civil War. All right, he says, okay, on to my question. If someone wants to defer Social Security past 70 to push income into the next tax year, and they are applying in December, and they want to apply retroactively for a September start date. Talk about a complex question to kind of follow. Yeah. Let me know if you need me to repeat any of this. What if they were married to a spouse who began their own benefit at age 62? Will Social Security know to apply that spouse's spousal top-off to the retroactive benefits? Or is there some other process that needs to take place to notify Social Security to apply the top-off of spousal benefits that will be occurring in our situation? Thank you very kindly, George from Ohio.
Interesting.
Do you need me to repeat any of that? Or did you follow it all?
No, I think I got... I thought he was going one direction, and then it turned out to be a little bit different. But let me first explain... The confusing part, I think, for most people following along is what he's attempting to do. He's attempting to do something we've talked about on the show a few times, which is take a strategy to push your Social Security benefits into the following year for tax purposes by waiting to file until the following year, but then filing retroactively. And they will then backdate your application. In this case, he's talking about filing, say, in January or so, but asking them to start his benefits back in September of the year prior. They will pay you in that following year, and it'll be taxed in that following year. So it's a way to avoid having Social Security pay out in 1 year, and it happens to be the year he's turning 70. And that's totally something you can do. We talk about people not benefiting from waiting past 70 to claim Social Security because you no longer receive delayed retirement credits. But this is a case where sometimes you do intentionally so that you can wait until the next year to then collect. Now, you'll get a lot of Social Security that following year, so you'll want to make sure it makes sense for you, because not only will you get your Social Security for that whole year, you'll be getting the retroactive lump sum for the months from the previous year. But he's not really going so much into that as to recognizing that when he files, I'm assuming it's him, but when this spouse that files at 70 or a few months after 70, that is unlocking the door to a potential spousal benefit for the spouse. And he wants to know, when he files retroactively back a few months, will they know to retroactively add the spousal benefit for his spouse? Highly unlikely that will happen automatically. I would almost guarantee it would not. All that's going to happen, and this isn't anything special about the retroactive benefits, it's more so, will they know to start spousal benefits when you file? And oftentimes when there's such a delay, you know, they say the one spouse claimed at 62, this is much, much later now, that the fact that has remained in the system to automatically turn those on, I don't think that's going to happen. So when you go in to file retroactively, your spouse should also file retroactively for the spousal benefits back to the same date that you're starting your retirement benefits. I think he mentioned September was that month. So I think, in fact, the spouse will get retroactive spousal top-off, I think is what he called it. It's usually called the excess spousal benefit. But that bump-up that you receive when your spouse claims, if you, in fact, are eligible for some spousal benefit. But it's not going to be automatic. So you don't have to think of trying to predict any special forms or anything like that. Just be open and talk to Social Security about this and tell them what you're trying to do. And they should be able to then enter it into the system so that it happens the way I think that you're hoping, which is the spousal benefit will also get the retroactive treatment, just like this age 70 retirement benefit for the spouse who's waited all the way to 70, and in this case, a few months past 70, in order to push their benefit start date into the next year while still receiving all the money they would have received had they started at 70. Just a little trick. And since I didn't mention it, that retroactive rule, you can claim retroactively back in most cases up to 6 months, but no further back than your own full retirement age, which if he's at 70, then he's way past his full retirement age. But he can pull this off using his dates because he's just trying to backdate it a few months back to September. So September, October, November, December, that's only 4 months retroactive that he's trying to accomplish. And just make sure you ask proactively for the spousal also to be retroactive back to that September date, and it should work.
Excellent. We haven't had that strategy discussed in a while.
True.
Okay, next Social Security question. This one came in from the website, helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, and he found us from Google search, he said. So he has no idea we have a podcast. He has no idea about giving state hints. See if he says where he's from. Oh, he did. Well, he said where he's from. See if I could get a hint from this state. All right. Remember when we were like in grammar school and you had somebody would say a word and then you had to kind of guess what it is? Like if somebody said ball, they might say bat.
So word association. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Word association. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to give you what you will get this. If you don't get this, you are dumb. is the only way to put it.
Wow. Okay. I hope I come
through. And everybody listening, I'm going to give one word, and you should have a state pop into your head.
Okay.
Everybody should get this. Ready for the word?
Ready.
I feel like password. The word is... Okay, the word, lobster. Oh, well, don't even
okay,
think.
Okay, I'm going to blurt out Maine, but...
Maine, yes.
The more I thought about it, I'm thinking, wait a minute. There's lobster in a lot of places beyond Maine up there. But yeah, we always talk about Maine lobster. It's very famous, so it's got to be Maine, right?
Maine, yeah. Yes.
Okay.
See that word association. And everybody listening, you should have thought Maine right off the top of your head.
By the way, this might also be an East Coast, out West kind of difference too. We don't call it grammar school. We call it elementary school out here for whatever reason. I don't know if that's an east of the Mississippi, west of the Mississippi thing, but I know what you mean by grammar school. I know that it means the equivalent of elementary school, but we always call it elementary school.
Maybe it's where I went to learn my mastery of the English language and grammar in general.
I don't think you want to go there.
All right. Here's his question from Maine. So he's a maniac. Mm-hmm. I am trying to figure out what my wife's Social Security benefit will be at her full retirement age. Mm-hmm. Her date of birth is 12/59, December of 1959. Her current benefit is estimated to be $1,100 a month. And if she waits till her full retirement age, she will get $1,250 a month. But my primary insurance amount is about $28,500 a year. Back when I was 66, I'm now 71. My current Social Security benefit is $49,000 a year. Do you need me to repeat any of these numbers?
I think I've got it. So back when he turned his full retirement age, his PIA was 28.5, but Correct. Now he's 71 and he's collecting about $49,000. So I think I've Correct. Got my notes so far. Mm-hmm.
Okay. My question, will my wife get 50% of $28,500 as her spousal benefit, if her personal benefit is less than that, or will that $28,500 be adjusted for inflation in any way?
Mm. Got it. So let me do a quick calculation here. So the 28.5 PIA, normally your spouse would be eligible to receive half of that, which is $14,250, which on a monthly basis would be about $1,188 per month. So now I understand why he's asking, because her own PIA, her full retirement age benefit, which sounds current, sounds like he's just pulled that recently, is $1,250. So from looking at it like that, it looks like she would not get a spousal benefit because her own benefit is a little bit higher. Lucky for him, that's not quite how it works. When there's an age difference like this, he's 71, she's got to be, well, about to turn, well, let's see, 12, December of 1959. She literally just turned 64. Is that the case? So 1959, 2023, December minus 1959. She's, 64. I just shouldn't have second guessed myself. So she's 64, going to turn her full retirement age at 66 in 10 months. So not too much longer, about less than 3 years at this point. And the $1,250 is slightly bigger than half of his old PIA. But this is a case where that, what I've called your adjusted PIA, comes into play. Your PIA, his in this case, does receive benefit of cost of living adjustments, the COLAs that have happened, ongoing. And she is eligible to receive 50% of that adjusted PIA. And by adjusted, I mean, your unadjusted or raw PIA, which is terminology I use. They don't use that at Social Security office. The raw PIA is your first PIA that they calculated when you first became eligible to claim your Social Security retirement benefit, which is the year you turn 62. The reason why we focus on that is the calculations and what happens to your PIA change after that point in your life. There's kind of there's a substantive change in how your Social Security benefit behaves after you reach 62. So they establish formally your PIA, which is then subject to adjustment thereafter. That's where this is going to play a part. So between 66 and 71, on my calculations, about 5 years, there's been, over the past 5 years, several noticeable cost of living adjustments to Social Security. Those are going to be applied to his PIA when they then calculate half of that. So I believe she will get a bump up. She will get more than her $1,250. What I don't know from him, and I don't have time to, I can't on the fly do all of this, is go look up all of the inflation adjustments over the last 5 years, apply them to that 28.5 PIA, and then divide it by two, because that's going to give a good estimate of what her benefit is currently. Now, the benefit's going to go up again over the next couple years because she's not reached her full retirement age yet. If she were to claim now, which she could, she'd get a reduced benefit. But if he's trying to get her the maximum spousal benefit possible, she'd want to wait until she is 66 and 10 months to claim that benefit. And it'll be based on his adjusted PIA. So based on his calculations without the adjustments, it's about even, half of his being about equal to hers. But once you put in 5 years of inflation adjustments on his PIA, half of his is definitely going to be bigger than hers. So I think, got good news for the guy. I think that's exactly how it's going to play out here.
Okay, perfect. So now we will get into non-Social Security questions. We got new question of the week. We have annuity questions, all sorts of different questions. And we will do the new question of the week first. How's that?
Sounds good.
All righty. This one's fairly straightforward. Came in on Monday. No hint. Didn't even tell us the state he's from, but we will call him George. He said, I have a quick question for you. I changed employers about a year ago and rolled my 401k into my new employer's 401k. But now I just discovered that I think it would have been I would have been better served by rolling those dollars into an IRA where I would have more investment choices. Can I roll that rollover amount out of my new employer plan and put it in a new IRA? I believe I heard over your radio show, or I think he means podcast, that I can, but I haven't managed to find any additional information to confirm this or explain how I can do so. Well, George, I'm going to tell you with a definitive maybe.
I'd probably say might be able probably. To do it. Probably. I'd go
definitive
so far
maybe.
As
maybe.
Yeah.
It's all going to depend on your employer.
Yep.
The IRS doesn't prevent it. I've said many a times on this podcast that I volunteer for a local Northern Colorado employer on their retirement board. I'll never name who it is and haven't and won't. But they have a rule. Any money that you transfer into their retirement account is available to you at any time. You can take it out as a withdrawal, or you can roll it right back into another retirement account or IRA. They don't put any restrictions on it. Some employers are different. You roll money in, it's stuck in there. It's stuck in there until they're going to allow you to get it out under plan rules or until you separate from service. Mm-hmm. So every plan is going to be different. What you need to do is get a hold of your plan administrator. You don't give me any indication if you have a big 401k with thousands of participants and dedicated staff, or if you're working for a small employer. either way, you've got to either call the custodian that's holding the 401k. That's going to be the company whose name is probably on the statement. Your company's name will be on the statement for sure, but you'll also see the custodian's name. And there should be an 800 number on there. Call with any questions. If you call them, most custodians have software that's programmed specifically for each employer's plan. So when you reach somebody, even if they don't know anything about your plan, once they type in your plan information, all the rules and regulations and features of your plan generally appear to them on the screen. So they should be able to tell you if your employer allows you to access those dollars after rolling them in. If they do, then you can complete paperwork to move the money out mm-hmm. and get it to the new IRA.
Right.
Anything you want to add?
I still think I would use the word probably because I've seen it pretty common from what you described where rolled in money, they realize you could have done something else with it. And while they like you to roll it in because there's economies of scale that the bigger the 401k is, it usually benefits everyone. So there's some encouragement to do so. They realize a lot of people wouldn't if they thought it was rolled in and then they couldn't get at it anymore. And so they choose to send it to an IRA instead. So that's at least in my mind why they are usually allowing this, but it isn't for sure. It's down to your particular plan and you'll have to check into it like Jim described. But I think I would use the word probably rather than maybe, because I think it's a little better than 50-50 chance.
Fair enough.
Just opinion.
Just opinion. All right. I think we got a question. Let me see if I can find it here. It's more of a PSA and a question mixed into one. I'm trying to see if I can find it. It was kind of a cute one, so I wanted to get to it, but doesn't look, hey, folks, again, it's Friday afternoon. Chris warned you on this. I could have sworn I had it opened. I will find it when you're starting to talk about something.
Okay.
So let's get to an annuity question. This question came in, 2 years ago.
Whoa. So still
June of 22. Not quite 2 years. Almost 2 years, but not quite.
Hopefully they weren't hanging on our answer before they moved forward with something.
I hope not. All right. It says, hi, Jim and friends, or should I call them lackeys, henchmen, or assistants? I think associates, because it's Jim Solnit and associates. I mean, I didn't call it Jim Solnit and lackeys. Not too many people would hire us. Or Jim Solnit and henchmen.
I don't know. Jim Solnit and friends sounds like a first phone. Sounds like an old folk music group or something.
Jim Solnit and friends. Yes. But we will call them associates, not assistants. Yeah. Okay. As you have been discussing annuities, he sent this in June of 22 during Annuity Awareness Month. I thought this would be an interesting topic for your Q&A show. How do you evaluate an existing annuity to decide if it fits within your current retirement plan? Things change. And if it doesn't, what are the options for getting out of the annuity? Let's pause there. Things change. We say that all the time, folks. Your retirement plan is etched in jello, not in stone. I jokingly say that to clients and on the podcast, but it's true. And something you may purchase at some point in time, as you'll see this gentleman purchased a few annuities, may no longer be appropriate. Or maybe they still are appropriate. You need to constantly check matters like that. I know at our firm, we generally say to people you can update your plan every 3 to 5 years. Maybe that'll be fine unless there's major changes. One of the things that Chris looks for when he makes a determination is he'll look at the old plan and the asset balances and the client's current situation. If the asset balances are way off, we may have to update the plan and determine why are they way off. Were the rates of return assumed in the plan too low or too high? Or did the client lose a lot of money, go through a divorce, lose money, bad investment? Or did he make brilliant investments and they have substantially more? So I don't think there's any, and Chris, correct me if I'm wrong or if you feel differently, I don't think there's any rule of thumb that you must update every blank number of years. I don't think as a firm we like to go longer than 5 years and would encourage our clients not to. But it's also not a standard approach that, hey, you need to update your plan every year. But you do have to remain flexible and recognize just because 5, 10, 15, 20 years later, a decision you made in the past no longer applies, don't beat yourself up over it. Don't use hindsight to say, oh, God, why didn't I do this or that? As long as the decision you made at the time was reasonable and the decision to get into the annuities that this gentleman got into, if it was reasonable at the time, that's what to me matters. Because they may not be reasonable anymore, that's just to be expected because life never flows as you predict. What is your thoughts, Chris, on that before we really get into his question?
Yeah, I think it's, in my mind, gone are the days where you automatically do a full-blown plan update on a regularly scheduled time frame. It's really more how life evolves, paying attention, if things are generally going, you know, the how you expected them to go. There's probably not a lot of value in spending the money and the time to recrunch the numbers to say, yeah, it looks like you're about where we expected kind of stuff. And it's really life changes or changes life throws at you that really need to be looked at again. And that can be as much, you know, triggered by simple things like what you mentioned, a noticeable deviation in account balances from where you expected. If those start to drift too much, that's a good indicator. Hey, something's going on here. We might need to look at it again to see what that is. Why is it that things are different than we expected? Or some things are more obvious. You move to a new state, you change your house, you realize, my gosh, we're traveling three times as much as we ever thought we would. And we never told Chris that. Stuff like that is obvious triggers for looking at it again. But
was that my cue?
Sure.
That awkward pause?
Awkward, okay. Yes.
So you're going to see in a second, Chris and listeners, this is a definite atypical person. But I think his situation and questions can apply to many people. Here are some specifics of my situation. Let me see. Wait, let me back up. I do want to read one more sentence before I get into that. How do you evaluate an existing annuity to decide if it still fits within your current retirement plan? If it doesn't, what are the options to get out of it? Let's assume it has not been annuitized. I wanted to point that out. Let's assume his annuities have not been annuitized. Remember, folks, annuitization is the verb. It's an action. True annuitization is where you give up access to the money in your annuity, and in exchange, you have received a lifetime stream of guaranteed income paid to you monthly, quarterly, or annually is usually your choice of those three. Sometimes it can be semi-annual, but usually monthly, quarterly, or annually. That's annuitization. If you simply have an annuity, you have a noun. You just have a product. You have an insurance product that will grow at a certain amount every year as spelled out in the contract with the potential to give you a lifetime stream of income if you were to choose to do so. He still has the noun. Keep that in mind. Okay, here's what I mean. He's an anomaly. I am a 42-year-old early retiree and a full Vanguard do-it-yourselfer now. It's not every day we come across someone at 42, and he wrote this 2 years ago, so he's 44 now, a 42 or 44-year-old retiree. He doesn't give us any info, Chris, of if he was one of those fire people and he lived like a pauper his early years and saved up money. Was he a tech startup owner or something and he sold a business and got a wonderful payout? Did he inherit money? No indication on how he retired at 42. Just that he is a 42-year-old early retiree. He said, at the start of my career, I was sold some variable annuities from a quote-unquote friend of the family. Yes, you can read an insurance agent who probably got big commissions. I did not at the time have a good grasp of what these annuities were and just went along with his suggestions. And yes, I know that's my fault. I have two separate variable annuities now, down from the five that I was sold. I transferred one to Vanguard a few years ago, but Vanguard has since dropped this service, and it is now with, and I'll mention the insurance company, Vanguard is out of the insurance business. Transamerica took over everything. So he has a Transamerica annuity. I have $220,000 of cost basis in that annuity and a current market value of $390,000. So it's a variable annuity, folks. Mm-hmm. It's now with Transamerica. He put $220,000 in it. It's worth $390,000 at least 2 years ago. I'm not sure what he has today. My other annuity is still with New York Life. Its cost basis is $137,000, and its current market value is $270,000. I will be out of the surrender period on that annuity this year. Now, that's 2 years ago, folks, so no surrender period, mm-hmm. and no surrender period in his Transamerica annuity. So now I am thinking I may want to move it to reduce the high fees that New York Life is charging me. I do not have any guaranteed income at this stage of my life. I live off my investments and have a mix of cash, brokerage, Roth, and traditional IRA assets. My variable annuities are about 25% of my total net worth. I'm only 42, so I can't withdraw from them without an additional 10% penalty. How do you suggest I go about analyzing how best to handle these annuities? What is the best way, in your opinion, I should be considering in using these accounts? And would there be any downside to transferring them to another annuity to perhaps reduce my fees? Or am I just stuck with them? There's a lot of moving parts here, Chris, mm-hmm. as I'm sure you will know. Mm-hmm. What's one of the first questions we ask someone when they tell us they have an annuity?
First thing is, why did you buy it? Because we're trying to gauge the purpose that they at least thought of at the time. I think he made clear that there wasn't a specific purpose. It was more he was talked into it by a family member. So there might not be a clear purpose to this. And even if there were at the time, today he's questioning what purpose they may serve in his retirement.
Right. And he's given us no indication if they are qualified or non-qualified annuities. Simply put, are they held inside an IRA? Hence the name qualified, meaning they qualify for tax treatment, or are they non-qualified? Industry jargon, I admit, but it means it's in a non-IRA. Now, that's important because if he closes the annuities, he will be taxed in the year he closes them. He's thinking, should I keep them? Should I move them? What should I do with them? Well, if he makes a determination he no longer needs annuities, period, and he closes them, he's got a 100,000+ gain in each annuity. That will be taxed to him as income, not capital gain.
Right.
Let's back up a little here, folks. Mm-hmm. He has variable annuities. That means the annuities are just an insurance wrapper. If they're not inside an IRA, and I'm going to guess they're not, but I don't know. I remember he bought them. He's only 42 when he wrote this. He has substantial growth in them. So I'm assuming he bought them well into his late 20s, early 30s for them to appreciate that much, over double. So for someone to have that much money in his late 20s, early 30s, I don't see how it would have been inside an IRA.
Right, I agree. Plus, he made a big deal about the cost basis, which would not be really
applicable, right,
if they're qualified. So I agree that we can probably read between the lines that these are not qualified annuities, and therefore cost basis matters.
Correct. So that means one thing to keep in mind, when you buy a variable annuity, you get to invest in the quote-unquote market. You will invest in products that look, talk, and act like a mutual fund. So it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, and talks like a duck. But Chris, is it a duck? No.
In this case, it's not.
It's called a separate account. It's not called a mutual fund. Sometimes it has the exact same name as its mutual fund cousin, but it's called a separate account. And the reason is the fee structure of those investments inside his annuity will be different than the fee structure outside of the annuity in a traditional mutual fund. But the insurance company in a variable annuity says, hey, you can put the money in, and while it's sitting there, it's going to grow tax deferred. And I'm guessing that's what his family friend sold him on. Gee, George, here you are in your late 20s, early 30s. You're making good money. Look at all this hundreds of thousands of dollars that you got. You're going to be paying taxes on all that. Buy this variable annuity through me. Your money will grow tax deferred. And this is the other thing they sold back then. And you're going to be able to rebalance and even change allocations whenever you want without any taxable gain.
Right.
So you're going to be able to design a nice portfolio. You're going to be able to rebalance into stocks or bonds to stocks, or move from this segment of the market to that without any capital gain issues, because it's all wrapped up in the annuity. And all of that is true. But one thing that they sometimes don't tell you is, in a variable annuity, you're still taking investment risk, but you are not being rewarded for that in the tax code. You're being penalized for that. In the tax code, if you buy an investment and that investment drops in value, you can sell it and offset that loss with gains and $3,000 of ordinary income. And if you have nothing to offset and you have gains, you generally, now they're talking about changing the laws in the not too distant future, who knows if they will, but generally speaking, you will be taxed at a lower cap gain rate than income rate, income tax rate. Mm-hmm. Annuities, you forfeit all of that for the tax deferral. So now this gentleman is, I think, saying to himself, and we're pointing out to you, the listeners who may not quite understand this, he's got kind of a tax issue here. Not only that, Chris, what's the first dollars to come out of his annuity?
It's in this day and age, it's what we call last in, first out. So last in was the gain. So what comes out first as he starts to distribute the money is all that gain, which is taxed as income.
So even if he wanted to kind of, because as he points out, he can't take money out of it because he's going to be faced with a 10% early withdrawal penalty. Because even though an annuity is not technically a retirement account, it's classified as one. And it does have a 10% early withdrawal penalty if you're younger than 59 and a half. So if he might be thinking, well, if I could just take out my basis and leave my gain in there, that'll help me. Nope, you can't do it. Now, if it was a brokerage account, he might be able to get at basis with specific share identification, try to sell some low gain holdings, which wouldn't incur many taxable issues, but you don't have that flexibility inside an annuity. Inside a variable annuity, first dollars out will always be his income, and income is always taxed as, the gains inside the annuity of the first dollars out. But coming from an annuity, those gains are not taxed as cap gains. They're taxed as income. So he's kind of in a bind. Mm-hmm. Now he's asking a few more questions. How do you evaluate? What should he do? Should he keep it? Should he not? That's a question you have to answer, listener. Chris and I can't. I don't know why you bought them originally. If it truly was just for the tax, quote unquote, free growth and the ability to rebalance them and reallocate them without a tax issue, I'm 100% in agreement. You need to be looking now at the fees. Mm-hmm. But if you, and you never mentioned this, but if you bought them for the living, most variable annuities were sold with a living benefit beginning in about 2008, 2009, 2010. And that might have still been too early for him to have bought them. That would have been, gosh, he would have been just about turning in his 20s, early 20s. It's possible he had hundreds of thousands of dollars back then, but I don't know. But if you did buy those annuities because they had what are called living benefits, and we'll talk about living benefits in more detail in June when for National Annuity Awareness Month, these are a benefit for an additional fee that insurance companies place on variable annuities and fixed indexed annuities to allow you a lifetime stream of guaranteed income while not doing what, Chris?
While not officially annuitizing the annuity, giving up your money to the insurance company with an irrevocable decision.
In other words, you get to keep a noun with lifetime stream of income, yep, and not the verb. Now, there's a lot of nuances with this. We're not going to get into it.
Yeah.
In June, I will. But generally speaking, you get less money, dollar for dollar, out of a living benefit than you do out of a more traditional single premium immediate annuity that Chris and I favor. But that's not all the time. And we'll talk about that in greater detail in June. But Chris, this listener never mentioned anything about income, a living benefit. Mm-hmm. He instead was concentrating on his fees. Mm-hmm. And saying, hey, I can get out of the New York Life annuity finally next year, which, again, this is 2 years later, so he's out of it now. I'm sure he's went ahead and done things already. I'm trying to teach other people. So again, with what limited info I have, I think he purchased the annuities for the tax, quote-unquote, free growth, and the ability to rebalance and reallocate without generating taxable gains. And if that's the case, then yes, you should be looking at fees. Because variable annuities, especially the kind you bought through a broker, tend to have very high fees, mm-hmm, approaching close to, I would say, 2.5% to 3% when you're all in. I don't know what you are at, but I would imagine somewhere around maybe even as low as 2% if you don't have an income rider. So I would say 2% to 3% fees. But there are newer, since you purchased these, newer IOVAs, investment-only variable annuities, another acronym. How would you even pronounce that? IOVA? IOVA?
Yeah, it's kind of elegant, yeah.
IOVA.
Sounds like the latest prescription medication for IOVA, lower back, yes, pain.
IOVA. I take IOVA twice a day. Have you ever listened to those? The list of things that can go wrong. Oh, my God. On any medication. I'm on, Eliquis, and I'm on something for my, a statin and some other little white pill I'm taking for my AFib. I stop reading every the little thing with everything that can go wrong, it depresses the hell out of you. And it's just like, well, all right, if I don't feel good, I'll just tell my doctor. But anyways, it's neither here nor there. Iova, investment-only variable annuity listener. These are relatively new, and what they're attempting to do is strip out a lot of the costs of a traditional broker-sold variable annuity. Now, historically, you had to get them or have to get them through an investment advisor, not a broker, not an insurance agent, and not a registered rep or stockbroker, because they will put you in just another high-fee commission-based product. You have to go to a registered investment advisor, or that's the firm. Registered investment advisor is the firm. You'll work with a IAR, investment advisor representative. They're the representative of the firm. Anyways, you'll go to an investment advisor, and they can put you in an IOVA at a very low fee. But then they're going to want to put their AUM fee on top of it. So you might be simply jumping from the frying pan into the fire.
Oh, my gosh.
And I nailed it. I nailed it.
I was waiting for that
one to go. We got the little clap.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. Here we go.
Thank you. Thank you. I knew I nailed it. It was in my head. I was like, I got this one. You're going to be going from the frying pan into the fire with some IOVAs. But, and I very rarely do this, before Nationwide, Jefferson National came out with an annuity, an IOVA, that they would offer to individuals directly. Then Nationwide bought them out. If I'm not mistaken, they are definitely available to investment advisor representatives. They're available to my firm. My firm has used these products to help our clients in expensive broker-sold variable annuities who did not buy them for the income benefit. I got to stress that. You do not do what I'm describing to this individual if you have an income rider. I know we have some of our clients. I have one. I have a variable annuity, a high fee variable annuity, but the income benefit I love. It's worth the fee to me. I'm getting a damn good income benefit from it. I'd never move that one. I don't think this guy has the income benefit. What I'm getting at, if you, because you said you are definitely a do-it-yourselfer Vanguardian now, so you might have enough with brokers and agents and even maybe advisors. Call up Nationwide and see, because Nationwide bought the old Jefferson National. I don't know, but they might go direct to the consumer now on their IOVA, investment-only variable annuity. Now, it's not fee-free. There's still going to be a cost with it. And I certainly don't want to get into the Nationwide old Jefferson National product on how they earn their money. But the fee on that particular product is going to be most likely substantially less than the fee you're paying for your broker-sold annuity. I don't know what your Nationwide annuity is, your Transamerica, because that's the old Vanguard, and Vanguard was known for low fees. So I don't know what Transamerica is doing. But the simplest way, listener, and any listener, if you have an old variable annuity and you don't know what you got, you pick up the phone, you call the insurance company, and you start asking them questions. You guys are smart. You're all engineer types. You may not be an engineer, but you got that personality, that mindset. Find out, what is my annuity charging? What are my investment options, my separate accounts, as I said? What are they charging? Can I get a prospectus for all of them so I can see what all the fees are? Maybe I want to move my holdings around. Do I have a M&E fee? Do I have a rider fee? Do I have an income rider? If so, what's the fee? Ask these direct questions and start getting some answers. You might find that Transamerica is fairly low priced as it is. If Nationwide doesn't deal directly with consumers, there might be some companies that do. More and more and more insurance companies are coming out with IOVAs, investment-only variable annuities, to appeal to investment advisors who don't want the commission products. The only problem is, if you go to an investment advisor for it, they won't charge you a commission and neither will the insurance company, but they're going to want their AUM fee, so you would have to factor that in. I'm trying to keep you away from their AUM fee. And our firm can't help you with it, so we wouldn't be able to assist you, even though we don't charge an AUM fee on those. We only work with clients of ours, not non-clients. So there's limited choices, but I think you might be able to get out of the higher priced annuities into a lower priced annuity. But these investment-only variable annuities, they still have, you're not going to get Vanguard 10 BIP type fees that you would in a Vanguard ETF. But you'll probably, if you don't have to use the investment advisor, you'll probably be able to be all in from around 20 to 60 BIPs, depending on what you decide to purchase inside it. For an annuity, that's still considered cheap. Mm-hmm. It's definitely not going to be Vanguard, mutual fund, passive, 8, 9, 10 BIP cheap. But it's not going to be 2.5, 3% that you pay in broker variable annuities. But now, why don't you answer, Chris? How does he evaluate what he should do with them, and should he keep them or not? What would you tell him if he was a new client of ours? What would you be asking him?
Well, I would make absolutely sure, without just guessing, that they don't have some type of income benefit attached to them, because it is certainly possible, especially as old as they are, that they might have a particularly attractive income benefit, and these things might be, you know, one or both might be a perfect solution for generating future income from them. So I would check that first, because you never want to move or change these. I always tell people, regardless of whether in hindsight you decided this was a mistake or not, this original annuity purchase, you've got it now. So let's assess the situation now and make sure we don't make a second mistake, compounding the first possible mistake of buying it in the first place. So I'd evaluate that, and that's going to require conversations with the insurance company to fully understand that potential benefit. If it ends up that it's purely investment only, then you've got what Jim's been describing is, let's at least try to whittle down the fees themselves on this thing by possibly moving it. But I do think, let's say they don't already have an income benefit, because it's an annuity, variable annuity in this case, there are opportunities for it to become income in the future. And maybe we make this part of the reserve that they're going to eventually use to annuitize down the road. Now, I know he's a Vanguardian engineer type. That doesn't mean that a Vanguardian engineer shouldn't consider lifetime secure income at some point in their retirement planning. And so I think understanding not just your current situation, but where your retirement is likely headed is useful in determining maybe what you should do with this now in preparation for using it for something down the road. That's kind of where I'd start the conversation and kind of see where it goes with this. But yeah, the way he describes it, I think he's feeling like he probably wouldn't have done it had he to do it over again. But that ship has sailed. He's got it. I think you just make the best. You try to make lemonade out of lemons if you consider this to be a lemon. And I'm not calling it that. Might have been a perfectly justifiable reason why he got these originally. But
yeah, the thing that's running through my mind, Chris, if we did some math there, he's not going to have much secure income. He's a 42-year-old retiree.
Right.
He's not going to have hardly any Social Security benefit to
Correct.
Speak of.
Yep.
And I don't know how he retired that early, but he did give a hint. I don't have a calculator. You do. Let me look at You might have picked up on this too. He's 42 years old. I don't know anything about him. He might have other things, but his balance is on his annuity is 390. Yeah. Let's call it 400.
Yeah.
And on the other one, 270.
Yeah, I already did
so
this.
So let's call it 670. That's a quarter of his wealth.
Right. So he's only got about $2.5 million, which sounds like a lot, but he's got a long retirement ahead of him. So it may not be as much as he thinks. Plus, like you mentioned, he being retired so young, he may not have very substantial natural occurring secure income. And that's why I said these might be the perfect tool if between now and when he turns on the income, maybe he gets it into one of these low-fee investment-only variable annuities.
Absolutely.
To help goose the balances over time by avoiding unnecessary fees. And then ultimately, those annuities will be turned into an annuity that can generate income for him down the road, as you can move annuity dollars to annuity dollars quite efficiently.
Absolutely. And that's where I'm leaning, listener. Again, we're making some broad assumptions, but I think our assumptions are fairly accurate. And these are non-qualified annuities. I don't think you have much lifetime secure income. You can't close them and take the money out. I don't think you have an income benefit on them, or you would have mentioned it. If you do have an income benefit, analyze that first, because you might have bought it at a time when it was still really good. Mm-hmm. They're okay now. They're not my favorite, as you can probably tell, listeners. But 12, 15, 17 years ago, they were crazy, crazy what the insurance companies were offering. Assuming you don't have that, I would be all on board of lowering your fees as best as possible with as lowest cost possible annuity with reasonable investment options, because this is a variable annuity. You want that growth, and you want to be able to get into some good low-cost index options, have a fairly low-cost fee to the insurance company to maintain the annuity. So do a little bit of homework if you haven't moved these already, and barring any income benefit that Chris and I don't know of, grow the hell out of those annuities. And one of the best ways is to stop wasting money in fees, especially the brokers who sold them to you. They're probably getting trails on them. Get rid of that. Get it growing, because in the future, you can transfer tax-deferred, not tax-free. You're going to have to pay taxes sooner or later, but you can transfer them from a variable annuity that might not have any type of good annuitization benefit right into a SPIA, single premium median annuity, the types of annuities that Chris and I favor. You're only 42 years old. What if you were to let this grow for 20 years? Or what if you could lower your fee by 100 or 150 bips, total all-in fee between the M&E fee to the insurance company, the agent fee, and any sub-account fees? What if you could, did I say separate accounts instead of sub-accounts before? It should be sub-accounts,
you,
not separate accounts.
You did say separate, but
okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, sub-account, yep. Folks. Somebody in the industry might have already sent an email out to me. You fool! So, I get it. It's not separate accounts, it's sub-accounts. All right. What I'm getting at, listener, is you should grow that annuity to as much as you can, because you can transfer the money tax deferred into a SPIA later, and that will allow you through the exclusion ratio to spread out the taxation, start receiving some of your basis right away, and turn it into a good income stream. So because you don't have Social Security, you can't access that money till you're 59 and a half, seven more years, well, five more years now, because email's 2 years old, but you can grow that annuity quite high and use it as your substitute to Social Security. It's never going to pay you what Social Security would have paid you, I don't think.
No, I think he's 15 years from 59 and a half, because he's only 40 something.
Yeah, that's what I said. Did I say 15 or 5?
You said like 5 years, I thought.
Oh, no, I meant 15. Sorry, listeners. It's Friday afternoon. So what I'm saying, over the next 15 years or more, you could grow that annuity, and I would look to reduce the fees on it as much as possible while maintaining good investment choices in the separate
sub-accounts.
And we'll go from there. I'm done talking about separate accounts and sub-accounts. Let's move on.
Okay.
All right. This one is an easy question.
I hope so, because Jacob's going to kill us if we go much farther.
Oh, we'll do one more.
We can do one more quickie.
Okay. Hi, Jim, Chris, and the gang. This email came in 23. I have heard you speak about not putting IRAs in a trust because of the massive tax issues. Mm-hmm. Let me pause there. You can never put an IRA in a the way you put an asset into a trust is you retitle the asset to the trust ownership. You cannot retitle your IRA to a trust ownership. And I don't think any IRA custodian would let it go through.
You, not even if you asked, right?
Yeah, they hopefully have software that would pick up on it. Because if you try to retitle it, instead of the Jim, my IRA might be, say, IRA FBO Jim Saulnia. Instead of it, was going to say IRA FBO Jim Saulnia Irrevocable Trust dated 3/22/24, something like that. Hopefully the custodian would pick up on it and say, no, you cannot retitle this to the trust. That's how you, quote unquote, put something in a trust. If you were to retitle an IRA to a trust, it's an immediate, full, taxable distribution to you, the owner of the IRA. Full distribution. But I think he's talking about beneficiary. I think the rest of his question is getting at, I heard you say you may not want to name an IRA as beneficiary, a trust as beneficiary on the IRA beneficiary form. But he continues, what about an annuity, though, that has some kind of death benefit? Okay, let's talk about that. Annuities are still always taxed as income. Always. Even the death benefit, up to the basis in the annuity, like the previous question. He put in 100-something thousand. That will be inherited tax-free by his beneficiaries. But any gain is taxable beyond the basis as income. So even if you had an annuity and you're thinking, hey, my annuity death benefit would pay into my trust, and maybe that money would be assumed or received by the trust tax-free. No. The basis would. The basis inside the annuity would pass to the trust via the beneficiary form tax-free, income tax-free, capital gains tax-free to the trust. But the earnings inside the annuity would get put into the trust as income. And what happens to income inside a trust, Chris?
If it's held within the trust, it gets pushed through the narrowest tax brackets in the tax code, and that trust will pay the highest marginal income tax rate in effect at the time on just any dollars over about $15,000 worth of income. So if you'd like to pay taxes as a billionaire, that's kind of misleading because somehow they figure out how to pay low taxes, but you get the idea. If you'd like to figure out how to pay taxes in the highest tax bracket possible, have it recognized in a trust.
And it's only if the trust holds the assets, folks. If the trust simply collects it all and then the trustee distributes it all in the same year, distributes this all to the beneficiaries, it'll be taxed at the beneficiary's tax rate, which is going to be much more favorable than the compressed rate that Chris talked about, where it's taxed at the highest rate after receiving $15,000 of income. Then he says, what about life insurance if I left that to a trust? Ding, 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 ding,
perfect.
Ding, ding.
Perfect. Yep.
That could be received tax-free by the trust. Why? Life insurance is paid out tax-free, not the death benefit of an annuity. They're both sold by insurance companies, but they're the mirror opposite of each other. An annuity is really the mirror opposite of life insurance, and I won't get into that. So the annuity death benefit would not pay into the trust income tax free. The gain will always be subject to income taxes if the trust holds it. The basis would be received tax free, as all basis is. But a life insurance policy, all of the death benefit of a life insurance policy, whether it's $100,000, $1 million, $2 million, $5 million, whatever it is, could be paid into the trust in one lump sum. And the trust doesn't have to pass it out. It could be an accumulation trust, not a conduit trust that by design, the conduit trust passes the income out every year. Accumulation trust is what most people want to create a trust for. It's for protection and control. You want to protect those assets from being lost to bankruptcy and creditors and things like that. And you want to control the distributions to the beneficiary so they don't become a spendthrift or something like that. Well, life insurance can pay into that trust tax-free. The trustee can hold the assets in the trust and give the beneficiaries nothing and owe no taxes. Now, if the assets inside the trust start to generate their own income and dividends and cap gains, if the trustee doesn't pass those out to the beneficiary, then yes, the trust will start filing a tax return and paying taxes on those at the very compressed rates. But there's investment tricks a trustee can do to help mitigate some of that. So anyways, listener, I think you're talking about naming these types of accounts as the trust, rather, on these types of accounts as beneficiary. IRAs? No. Taxed as income. Roth IRAs? We didn't talk about that. Wonderful. Life insurance? Wonderful. Brokerage accounts, wonderful. Why, Chris, on brokerage accounts?
Because those brokerage accounts, at least under current law, will get a step up in basis and therefore could transfer at death with no immediate tax implications to the trust.
Exactly. But IRAs, I call them always taxable accounts for a reason. They're always taxable. The entire IRA pays into the trust. If the trust holds it, boom. You're going to lose 40, 50%, depending on what state you live in, between federal and state taxes, gone. Annuities, the death benefit, even though they might call it a death benefit, like insurance companies call their life insurance companies call it a death benefit, an annuity death benefit, totally different. And the gain beyond the basis the decedent put in, even though it's paid as a death benefit, is still taxable. Okay. Yeah. Anyways.
That's a good point. Well, great. Well, that'll bring us to the end of another Q&A show. It actually went more smoothly than I was expecting at this hour on a Friday. So nice job, Jim. You even nailed the frying pan into the fire.
I nailed it.
Wow. Nice job.
Thank you.
You can revel in that all weekend long, have a little celebration. But if y'all want to send in your own questions for the show, just send them to Jim directly. jim@jimhelps.com is the email address. In the subject line, put that it's a question for the podcast. That'll catch Jim's attention. And if you have a nice, interesting, concise question for the show, that'll increase your chances of getting hearing your answer here shortly on the show, but sometimes it takes a while. We'll pluck them out. We'll pluck random ones out, even a couple years old, if they still are relevant.
Kind of like this week.
Like the one this week. But we always do at least one question that just came in fresh this week. So you do have an opportunity. If you hit it just right with a good question, you might get your answer very quickly on the show. So we appreciate everybody listening and sending in questions. Jim, have a nice weekend, and I'm going to head out and get this to Jacob so he can upload it and go home before it gets dark on a Friday evening.
Excellent. I will chat with you later.
Great. We'll be back with everybody next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.